Michigan, the Tech Man in Limerick. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2WGB. That's Eric Guys, tries to control this, try to act net control to this enthusiastic group that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, how to make all this hardware work better, and how to get greater understanding for the wireless technology. That's not the only subject discussed on the TechNet, though those are the main ones. That's the starting subject. Ham radio operators are, in my opinion, to some degree, there's a scientist locked inside of that body that has an awful lot of curiosity about how the world of physics and electronics works. So we try to discuss those subjects. During the first hour, the majority of what's discussed on the TechNet is purely ham radio type questions. We make a sincere effort. Let me drop. For everybody who signs into the TechNet during the first hour, we make a sincere effort to give them at least a brief answer. In theory, a person doesn't have to wait more than an hour to get an answer to his particular question. Beyond that first hour, we then go into the mailbag for those who don't yet have a ham radio license and they've got some questions. Without the ham radio license, they can't get on here and talk to us directly, which is the main method. Most likely we'll also have a report from Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert. And after that, we go into a deeper matter quite often. And maybe tonight we'll even get into some discussions on Hurricane Sandy and the situation in Connecticut, the shooting and so on, and ways of making improvements. Ham radio operators are interested in those subjects because those were disasters in which communication was required. Ham radio operators made a significant contribution, particularly during Hurricane Sandy. Let me drop. Once again tonight, we're going to make a sincere effort that in between each communication, when we drop, we should wait for the four beeps, and then 1 or 2 seconds beyond, there are people, particularly in Canada, who get timed out and they no longer can hear what's going on if we don't obey that rule, if we just start talking on top of each other, so to speak. There's even a possibility you're going to be hearing some jamming tonight, because there is a disgruntled individual out there, a very unhappy person, who I am guessing is without a job, living with his parents, or house-sitting, and has an awful lot of time on his hands, and he thinks that being anonymous and jamming this particular repeater, he thinks that's fun, as long as he can remain anonymous. So get away with that for a period of time, and then as corrective action takes place, he will eventually no longer be able to do that for a whole bunch of reasons. So for the time being, we may have to put up with that. He doesn't stop us, he slows us down. And somehow he feels that he's getting pleasure out of that, which is a sad situation. But you guys being pretty tough, you can tolerate that. Okay, I'm ready to start taking questions, sign-ins. In other words, you're going to give me your call letters, your name. A lot of people forget that. I'm very forgetful, so you got to give me your name, even though I'm supposed to know you very well. Followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just to say that you're listening. Some people do, and they feel more satisfied for doing that. But after 30 years of the TechNet, and this is TechNet number 4,130, the series that began in September of 1982. By now, we sort of believe somebody out there is listening and it doesn't have to be confirmed. This particular repeater has, let me drop. This particular repeater has rather good coverage of the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and there's a lot of brain power present in that area. We try to tap into that. If you have knowledge on the subject being discussed, please sign in and tell us the benefit of your experience, because John and I, people think we try to act like we know it all. We know darn well we don't. And so we give a beginning of an opinion, and quite often that needs to be corrected. Everything you hear on the TechNet is not going to be 100% accurate the first time, but there's a kind of peer review taking place by way of this public transmission of our opinions. By way of the website you can go to called www.amateurradio.tangovictor. There you'll find the last 6.5 years of TechNet recorded. And you can, and the first 4 or 5 years of it is even documented as to what subject is being discussed each one of the 5 or 10 minutes. By way of that publicly available body of data, people can review that gain something from it, find the errors, come back and tell us, and we make that correction. There are professors out there of electrical engineering schools who have been telling their students to listen to the TechNet or go to that website as a method of becoming more acquainted with the modern-day world of wireless technology, because the methods by which that subject is taught in schools could be done better. The curriculum doesn't change fast enough. That's an opinion. Okay, give me your call letters and name and the word yes if you've got a question or a comment for the net right now. K2RIW.
BB2ZEX. Jerry, yes.
It's 32, VBN, Paul Rockaway, listening at this time on my 8th.
Okay, VBN from Paul Rockaway. I think you signed in last week, and I think we didn't get a chance to get back to you. Is that true? Give me your full call letters one more time and your name, sir.
Yes, KB2, Mr. Bravo November, Freddy. I just moved out here from the Bronx, and I can't make the repeater, which is HP, from inside the house before I get an antenna that fits out the window.
Okay, you're a little bit noisy, but from far Rockaway and used to be in the Bronx, you're working it quite well. You're making it quite well, Freddy. Freddie, last week you signed in, and then when we got over to you, you didn't come back to us. So when that happens, when a person signs in 1 week and we don't come back to him, that puts him number one on the runway next week. So we're going to go to you number one. But let me find out first who else has signed in. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW in the deck net.
Mr. Yes,
Master
Paul.
Okay, I heard West, but there was a double. Who was the other person?
WB2ZEX, Jerry, yes.
Hey, we got you, Jerry. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul with a space report.
KC2ZUM, no, just listening.
Okay, we got ZUM with a no, Paul with a space report. One last call. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW. There may have been a very weak audio in there. We'll try again a little bit later. Freddie, let's see now. When it comes to adding an antenna at Far Rockaway, you've got a guy named Barry into Moon Bounce, who lives on Beach 43rd Street in Far Rockaway, and I guarantee you could get lots of help from him for adding an antenna to your house, so your handy talky will sound a little bit louder. I'm pretty sure you did sign in last week, and we didn't get a chance to talk to you again. So, Victor Bravo 2, Victor Bravo November, I think it is, K2LAW. Go ahead, Freddie.
Yes, sir. KB2, yeah, I'm on ground level. I'm on the first floor. It's hard to make the repeater unless you come outside in the building there.
Okay, you're a little bit noisy. You sound pretty good from the ground level. Even though you think that outside versus inside is going to make a big difference, if the house is made out of wood like most houses in Far Rockaway are, I think when you go to the second level of the house or the attic of the house, it will work quite a bit better. On top of that, Freddie, the simplest, cheapest antenna in the world, you could build some kind of a ground plane antenna out of coat hanger wire and connect it to an SO239, a chassis mount UHF connector. Use the four little holes for the four radials and the center conductor for the radiator. That kind of an antenna, suspended by a string from the ceiling of the second floor of the house, or if you really get a chance to put it on the chimney of the house, that could make you 10 times louder, Freddy. Not kidding. Altitude makes a big difference on 2 meters. With a piece of RG-58 coming down to the first floor, that's where you want to operate your handy-talkie from. And most handy-talkies have a BNC connector where you can unplug the rubber duck and plug in that cable. So the simplest coat hanger antenna at a high location in your house or outside your house will make you a hell of a lot louder. It may even make you so loud that you can go down to the low power level of your handy-talkie and really save the battery. So that would be a fun project. If you Google the word ground plane antenna, coat hanger wire antenna, simple ground plane antenna, I guarantee you'll find some websites that'll help. And if you happen to walk over to Barry's house, into Moon Bounce on Beach 43rd Street. He'll also give you some hints along those lines. So that would be the next level of improvement. That would give you a lot of fun, and I recommend you do that, Freddie. KB2, Victor Bravo, November. K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Roger, that sounds good. I've been listening to this thing ever since I was in Manhattan for the last 15 years. I came from Manhattan and went to the bus, and now I'm in Far Rockaway. Sounds good to me.
Okay, you may know, Freddie, that John has a special award that he gives out for people who start off in Manhattan, and then go to the Bronx, and then go to Far Rockaway, and 15 solid years of listening to the TechNet. John's got an award that they call it the Tri-County Award, John, Freddie. So maybe you're eligible for the Tri-County Award for the TechNet. I'm having a little bit of fun with you, Freddie. Back to you. And by the way, do come back and let us know as you build that simple antenna out of the coat hanger wire you've got in your closet. Even if you get the length a little bit long, just by getting the altitude up there with a piece of either RG58 cable or RG6 cable or RG59, the cable you use doesn't matter too much, and plug that into your handy-talkie and hang that as high as you can in the house or outside the house, you'll be amazed how much it'll make you louder, because you've heard me say it a lot of times, Freddie, there's three things to make a VHF antenna work well. And those three things are altitude, and altitude. You can have a gold-plated antenna in the basement, or you can have a yucky $2 worth of antennas in the attic, and the second one will work a hell of a lot better. So good luck with that project, and come back and let us know how it turns out. Okay, Jerry's the next guy on the list, WB2ZEX. Go right ahead, Jerry. K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, WB2ZEX. Good evening, happy holidays. Had an interesting question. I had a triplexer, 2 meters, 440, and 220. I had a separate 220 radio, and I had the 2-meter radio, 440, had two separate outputs going to the 2-meter and the 440 side of the triplexer with the tri-band antenna. Now I have a new dual-band radio that has one output for 2 meters and 440. Do I have to put a second duplexer to separate the signal to go into the triplexer, or could I use a T-connector out of the antenna, one cable going to the 440 side and the other cable going to the 220 side?
I'm reasonably sure that the one cable coming out of your rig on 220 and 440, I think, are the two frequencies, with a T-connector going into the 220 and 440 input of your triplexer, will work like a charm if the length of cable from the T-connector to the 220 input and the length of cable to the 440 input is the right length of cable. Most likely, I'm not positive now, but most likely your triplexer on the 220 port will act like a short circuit on 440, most likely. As such, if there's a quarter wavelength of cable on 440 going from the T connector to the 220 input, it'll be most ideal. Let me show you what's happening. A quarter wavelength of cable does impedance inverting, Jerry. When you put a short circuit at one end, it's an open circuit on the other end. So if you've got a quarter wavelength of cable with velocity factor on the 440 frequency, but that piece of cable is going from the T connector to the 220 input, that will automatically create an open circuit on that end of the T connector when you're on 440. That'll stop any of the signals from going from the T connector on 440 into the 220 input. And by the same token, from the T connector to the 440 input, if there's a quarter wavelength of cable there on the 220 frequency, you'll have the automatic switching. So by a quarter wavelength of cable in the two places between the T connector and the two inputs to the triplexer, it'll act as an automatic open and closing switch. Let me drop it and I'll show you why. Everybody believes that a bandpass filter works by passing the signals you want on the right frequency and not passing the frequencies on the frequencies you don't want. Everybody sort of knows that. They don't bother thinking about how does the filter do that. If you had a network analyzer or any kind of laboratory test equipment, and you measure the standing wave ratio going into your bandpass filter, you'll discover that across the plate, the band of frequencies where the filter is supposed to pass the signal, on the input connector, the filter acts like a 50-ohm resistor on those frequencies. And the frequencies that are not supposed to pass through the filter, you might say, how in the world does the filter do that? Well, with the right kind of test equipment, you'll find out that on the frequencies where the filter doesn't want to pass the frequencies, it does that by acting like a short circuit on those frequencies. So, if I'm building a filter that's supposed to pass, let me pick a number, 430 to 440. Between low frequencies and 430, the filter will act like a short circuit on the input. Let me drop. Between 430 and 440, in my example, the input impedance to the filter will be 50 ohms when the output is properly terminated. Between 440 and much higher frequencies, the filter will look on the input like a short circuit again, very high vis one. Believe it or not, most filters do their filtering by presenting a short circuit on the input connector on the frequencies that you don't want to pass through the filter. That's how it does it. In fact, you could tune up the filter without even looking at the output. Put nothing but a 50-ohm resistor on the output. Tune all the adjustable things on your filter, looking at nothing but the swept input standing wave ratio. And if you want the filter to have real good pass band between 430 and 440, in my example, you simply tune all the knobs on the filter until it gives you a perfect standing wave ratio, as low as you can get, between 430 and 440, and simultaneously make sure that it gives you what looks like a short circuit on the lower frequencies below 430 and the higher frequencies above 440, in my example. So most filters do their passing and rejecting by acting like a short circuit or a 50-ohm load for the undesired and desired frequencies accordingly. Once you know that, and once you know that a quarter wavelength of cable will convert a short circuit to an open circuit at the G connector, you can use all that as an automatic switching arrangement. I know that this is a little complicated the first time you hear it, and when you go back to the amateurradio.tv and play it back a few times, it should make a little more sense. And if it doesn't, you're allowed to come back next week and ask the question again, Jerry. WB2ZEX, K2L.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And WB2ZEX. Actually, I do record everything, and we do send the feed to W2LIE from my house, so it's live on there 30 seconds back. But actually, it's a 144 and 440 radio, not a 220 radio, so the 220 will be separate, so I just have to use a an 19-inch wire for the on the 2-meter side and whatever the length is on the 440 side with the 220 radio will just be plugged in separately.
You've got the principle, Jerry, but there's one catch. You said a 19-inch wire on the 2-meter side. If it was a resonator in free air, 19 inches is the right length. But since you're doing this in coax cable, you now got to include the velocity factor of the cable. If you didn't do that, this whole technique of quarter wavelength of cable is pretty forgiving. You can have 10 or 20% of error in the length, and it'll still work pretty well. But you got to include the velocity factor. If you were using ordinary RG58 cable with polyethylene dielectric, which has a 66% velocity factor, then you'd want to use a length of 19 inches times 0.66. It went 66% of 19 inches. You got to use the velocity factor of the cable, because in this case you're doing it inside a cable, not a resonator in free air, where it would be 19 inches. See if that makes some sense, Jerry. WB2ZEX, K2RIW.
K2RIW, WB2ZEX. Okay, and of course the triplex, so I have to get a new one, whether it'll come with a coax cable, a connector's right on it, or a little short length of
happens with a fan dipole. If I built a fan dipole where I want to work on 80 and 40 meters, and one of the pieces of dipole is 132 feet long for 80 meters, and the other piece of the dipole, the other dipole right alongside of it with a few feet of separation at the end, is 67 feet long for 40 meters. And then I connect them all together at the center with one transmission line, and maybe with a balun if I'm going to be a purist. What happens in that case is when you're on 80 meters, the 80-meter dipole presents a 70-ohm load, and 98% of the power flows down that dipole when you're on 80 meters. And when you're on 80 meters, the 40-meter dipole is almost a pure capacitive load, probably 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance. As such, it's almost an open circuit, so to speak, or at least highly reactive, and very little power on 80 meters, hooking down the 40-meter dipole. And by the same token, when you're putting 40 meters down the transmission line, the 40-meter dipole is a beautiful 70-ohm resistive load. The 80-meter dipole is now almost a perfect open circuit. It's now one wavelength long instead of a half wavelength long. It probably is an impedance of a few thousand ohms, extremely close to an open circuit, and none of the 40-meter energy will flow into the 80-meter dipole. So it's an automatic switching arrangement because of the way the impedances behave. And by way of your T-connector and the right length of cable, knowing that your filter is pretty close to a short circuit on the frequencies that it's not designed to pass, that's how it does its frequency selecting, by being an almost a short circuit on the input. It's hard to believe, but it doesn't really change its passband. It changes its input standing wave ratio. That's what a filter really does. And many of the books don't make that clear. So after you do that first experiment with the T-connector and the various lengths of cable, including the velocity factor of your particular cable, come back next week and tell us how it works, Jerry. Good luck with that project, and it should work very well. Let's see. The next person who signed in was also ZDX, I suddenly realized. Go ahead, Wes. What's your comment? I wonder if you've ever done that. Go ahead, Wes.
And takes in. Actually, I'm waiting. I have a 20.4 megahertz filter, and I'm waiting for the vector network analyzer to load. But in the meantime, the antenna, say dipole, it is a bandpass filter, isn't it? And takes in.
You're absolutely right. Everyone believes that when you put signal down the transmission line and it hits the antenna, they want to believe that the signal then goes down that antenna and just jumps into space. Absolutely not. If you really could see that signal going down the antenna, you would find that 95% of the signal is left over when the signal goes down the wire and hits the open circuit end at the far end. And almost all of that signal reflects. And it's going to come back to the input end. Quarter wavelength down on the right-hand side, quarter wavelength bounce back, half wavelength later. What you and I call resonating of an antenna is to recognize the fact that every real radiating antenna of finite size, in other words, not a rhombic where it's a zillion wavelengths long, but an ordinary antenna that's about a half wavelength long, the signal bounces back and forth 10 or 20 times before it finally gets radiated. Radiating is hard. Let me drop. So we make the antenna electronically a half wavelength long to make sure that all of those bounces stay in step with each other. That's what resonance is. They all are on the same phase. They're all in step. Therefore, because it has to be in step on the frequency where it resonates, where the frequency you designed it to radiate on, it is a bandpass filter. And it's a kind of a funny bandpass filter. It works on the first, on the fundamental, the third harmonic, the fifth harmonic, because on odd harmonics, the signal comes back one cycle later, but at least it comes back in step, and therefore all the bounces stay in step. So an 80-meter dipole will also work on three times 80-meter frequency, which happens not to be a ham band, I think. Let's see, three times 3.5. is around 10 megs or so, or 12 megs, It's not a normal hem band, but still, dipoles work on fundamental third and fifth harmonics, so to speak, but they have to resonate, therefore it is a bandpass filter. That's why a fan dipole works so well. It automatically does the switching. Okay, the next person who signed in was KC2ZUM.
Dick, keep it in mind, I don't see that the fact that you were talking about shorting the circuit on the vector network, and I see that the frequency changes when I go up and down of the filter.
When you're using a network analyzer, and you're looking at the input of a filter, and the output is going into a 50 ohm termination, the right way to test it, you will find a band of frequencies, a so-called pass band, where the dot on the network analyzer, if it's being displayed as a Smith chart, the dot will go to the center of the screen, or very close to the center of the screen, during the pass band frequencies, on all of the frequencies where the filter is rejecting the signal, the dot will move out very close to the perimeter. And yes, it's going to walk itself around the perimeter, where it's highly capacitive, highly inductive, and whether it is a short circuit or an open circuit almost doesn't matter. It is a highly reflective object on the frequencies that it's not passing. That's what a bandpass filter does. A dipole antenna looks somewhat similar. If I took a bandpass filter made for 3.7 megacycles, and if I took a half-wave dipole, which is the right length at 3.7 megacycles, and I put both of them on my network analyzer, and I've normalized the network analyzer for the end of the cable where it touches the filter, or the end of the cable where it touches the dipole antenna. You got to worry about that. If you don't do the right kind of calibrating for the length of your cable, life gets more complicated. You get an answer that requires more interpretation. Let me drop. But once you normalize the end of the cable, and you look at that half-wave dipole on the Smith chart, and you look at your simple one-pole bandpass filter tuned to 3.7 megacycles on that network analyzer, they will look very similar. If somebody gave you that display off the network analyzer Smith chart and asked you which one of these displays is the dipole antenna and which one of them is the filter, it might be very difficult to find out until you sweep far enough in frequency where you're on the third harmonic. On the third harmonic, the dipole will come back into a pretty good looking impedance. The bandpass filter will not do that. So until you sweep far enough, they will look very similar. Is that sort of what you're asking, Wes? M2XJN, K2RIW?
Actually, I see confirmation of that, what you're saying. Even if I have Smith with J plus G plus JB and R plus JX, and even if I have a polar, the pattern is exactly the same, the only that the background which you have is either polar or the Smith chart. But it goes on the polar, it goes to zero, to the center of the circle. That makes a small loop and then goes around to the left and to the right, which shows me the inductive or the capacitive character. And I recall I had a very much similar picture on the screen when I was playing with a dipole. And so
yeah, when you set a network analyzer for a polar plot or a Smith chart plot, believe it or not, the dot picture on the screen is identical. The only thing that changes is the grid work. It's the exact same answer in both cases, polar plot or Smith chart. They're the exact same plot. But whether you use the Smith chart grid work on the screen or the polar plot grid work on the screen will make the answer look a little bit different. The polar plot is most frequently used when you're looking at bandpass characteristics, where you want to know amplitude and phase of something like an amplifier. And you're using the input of the amplifier and displaying the output on the screen. But you could display the input standing wave ratio of the amplifier, or the input standing wave ratio of an antenna, and plot that as a Smith chart on the network analyzer. Network analyzer gives you a lot of information in a hurry. That's the good news. Figuring out what it all means is going to take some time. I wish there were some books that make it a little bit simpler. I think there's an ARRL book that makes Smith chart understanding a lot simpler. It's the modern day equivalent of the most universal tester in most good radio laboratories. Let me drop. In the old days, you and I used to measure standing wave ratio, phase shift, and all kinds of things like that with a slotted line. And 30 years ago, it worked very well, but it was very tedious. And there's 10 different ways you can do it incorrectly. You think you're going toward the load, you're really going toward the generator, and so on. You can get it backwards in three or four places in this multi-step process to use a slotted line to figure out what's happening. And so the smart guys at Hewlett-Packard in the late 60s came up with this thing called network analyzer. It really is a single generator with an amplitude and phase detector. Call it an oscilloscope. Call it a fancy oscilloscope combined with a signal generator all in one box. So it gives you a signal coming out of the box, going to your device on the test, and you either look at what gets reflected in amplitude and phase, you call that a Smith chart, or you figure out how much goes through the amplifier, if that's what you're testing, how much bigger is the output signal, and what's the phase angle of it, and display that on a polar plot. So a network analyzer really is the right way to go, and if you went and bought the real instrument from somebody like Tektronix or Hewlett-Packard, let me drop, you buy the real thing, and it's a great instrument with results that are traceable to the Bureau of Standards, it tends to be very expensive. Sounding question. However, I gave as an example the fish that's called shark, which only stays alive if it continuously is moving. That's just the way a shark works, the way his breathing apparatus works. He's got to continuously be moving. And I suddenly came to the conclusion that a radio wave only exists if it's continuously moving. You cannot make a radio wave sit still. You can make it look like it's sitting still when you set up a standing wave. But the standing wave is really two waves continuously moving, one going up the cable and one coming back down the cable. And the way they interfere with each other, the upgoing and the downgoing one, it looks like you've got a standing wave and it's sitting still. It's really moving. So radio waves only exist when they're continuously moving, and as such, they have to be bouncing back and forth between the walls of your bottle or your chamber, like your microwave oven, and they die down usually in microseconds. Thank you.
able to match. Now, again, for the more complex networks that had four elements, high band, low band, like a high L or an L, whatever. I think he went to work for a couple of the military concerns on the West Coast, and after that, honestly, I lost touch with him. He did a fine piece of work while he was at Berkeley. I know he has one patent on, I think it's some kind of a filter, an evanescent filter of some kind, as I recall, when he was working. But that goes back to about 2000, Dick, and that was the last I touched base with him. Go ahead.
Good information. Just look where we got on this one, John. So that guy who wrote you this article, I mean this proposed antenna, he's on to a good thing. And Mike, I called it the modern day equivalent of a screwdriver antenna. What name would you give this antenna? I think you see, I'll describe it to you again, Mike, because you tuned in a little bit late. One of the people who wrote in to the mailbag at John, KC2WGB, was proposing this antenna on 10 meters, consisting of a pair of half-inch diameter copper tubing. He's building a quarter-wave-like ground plane antenna for 10 meters. Has conventional ground plane radials on 10 meters. The beginning of the radiator is a piece of half-inch diameter copper pipe 36 inches long, ending with a very large washer at the end of it, 4-inch diameter washer, soldered onto the end of the copper tubing. There's a piece of phenolic rod going into that upper copper tubing right where the great big washer is with a half-inch diameter hole in it. And now you have another piece of tubing on top, 80 inches long, with a washer on the bottom. So as you move the phenolic rod in and out, you're moving the two pieces of copper tubing closer and further apart, which really means the two 4-inch diameter washers are being moved closer and further apart. So the antenna is really 8.8 feet long. It's beyond quarter wavelength on 10 meters. But because he's got this series capacitor a third of the way up the antenna, he's bringing it back into resonance even though it's a little bit too long. By changing the penetration of the phenolic rod, which allows him to move the two washers closer and further apart, changing the capacitance in series with these two pieces of tubing, 36 inches long and 80 inches long. He tunes it into resonance anywhere he wants in the 10-meter band. By that process, I am predicting with slight modifications of the copper tubing length, I think he can make this antenna remotely tunable with some kind of a stepper motor that changes the penetration of the phenolic rod. I think he can make this antenna tunable from 15 meters to 17 meters to 10 meters, is my prediction. And see, he's now controlling the reactive component. He's making the radiator resonant at those frequencies by this tuning procedure. The only thing he hasn't got is a perfect resistive component. With the right selection of an L network at the base of this antenna, L network between the ground plane and the radiator, and the junction between those two elements of the L goes to the center conductor of the transmission line, he now has the ability to take this thing resistively and control it. I'm guessing the base of this ground plane antenna is going to be 30 ohms resistor, and to get it up to 50 ohms, the L network will do that for you. That's how we got into the L network. So I think you see the process. I'm calling it the modern-day equivalent of a screwdriver for those three bands, a VHF screwdriver. You might have an even better name. That you see the principle of my WYQU after the four beeps, KQRIW in the TechNet. Okay, Nick, I get the picture. I was drawing a picture, sketching it as you were talking. It sounds interesting enough. My only question, I have two questions. First of all, how is he, or is he changing the length of the ground radials? Is this antenna going to be ground mounted, or is he have some kind of an elevated counterpoise? And if so, is he trying to tune these also, or is he just going to cut them long and adjust the impedance at the base of the antenna accordingly? Go ahead. His original proposal was for 10 meters only. And therefore, he would choose the ground plane radials to be the right length for the middle of the 10-meter band. It was my suggestion that he go a little bit further with the tuning process once he adds this remotely controlled motor. This is going to be a base antenna, not a mobile antenna. And I was talking about making him use it between 15, 17, and 10 meters. And you've got a good point. The ground plane radials will be most effective where they are quarter wavelength long. And if he made them a quarter wavelength long at 17 meters, they're going to be a little bit too short at 15 and a little bit too long at 10 meters. The only thing I see that goes wrong when your ground plane radials are not quarter wavelength long is they don't do as much choking action. In other words, they act like a kind of a choke, stopping the RF energy from flowing down the outside of the coax cable. If he's willing to use the right kind of a balancing device at the base of the antenna, where the coax cable meets it, the fact that the ground plane radials are now reactive, he can compensate for that. The balancing device at that point, which could be a number of turns of coax cable just wound together with a tape, so to speak, acting as an RF choke at the base of the antenna, would do the compensation. The fact that the ground plane is now reactive, as long as it doesn't have the ability to launch a signal on the outside of the transmission line, that is all correctable as an impedance-adjusting device within the radiator and within that L network. So he can compensate for that. And the ground plane radios in that circumstance don't have to be perfect, in my opinion. You might have an opinion on that one, Mike. WYQU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, I think I agree with you. And I don't see why a Balun device wouldn't work. I just did a quick assessment of a quick topology on 18 megahertz. The resistive portion of the antenna, when the two tubes are pretty much all the way extended out, about 18 ohms or so, of course, in series with reactants. But as long as the balancing device, you're going to match this antenna with an L network at the base. The resistive component probably is not going to vary much between maybe about 15 ohms and as high as maybe 50. So the simplest balance should be able to choke off the RF at the base. I don't think it hit anything exotic. The impedance of the antenna is not going to soar, so you're not going to have to worry about too much inductance in the balance to take care of that. So, no, I agree with you. It should work fine here, Dick. It sounds like a patentable design if this fellow wants to improve on it a little bit. K2RIW in the net, WY2U.
Fantastic. Hey, John. John, you got to start hanging an antenna. You got to start hanging a shingle on your QTH or on your website, John. Antennas designed while you wait. this submittal to the mailbag has a darn good beginning idea. We've had a couple of glitches to it, doodads to it, as Mike has. So antennas designed while you wait. It's time to hang out a shingle like that, Sean. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I'm just afraid it'll draw more to the mailbag than I can handle. But yeah, that antenna sounds great, and that's a good idea with poor man's Ballon and the L network you're talking about. I'm going to, well, he'll hear this when he listens to the program, so he's got a good project for the spring. That's what it sounds like to me. KC2WGB.
And you heard Mike say that he thinks it might be patentable, the total structure that we're describing with all the doodads. And the way the patent world works within the United States, from the time you make it a publicly announced structure of some kind like this, you've got a one-year clock running. So, unfortunately, the TechNet is a kind of a public forum. It's no longer held close to your chest. So he's got 1 year to file the patent if he wants to. And whether or not he should is another whole series of things to be considered. It's a little bit expensive. The patent itself, once you get it, is something you can be very proud of. Let me drop. The patent is something you can be very, very proud of. That's the good news. And if you think you're going to a manufacturer of the device, or if you're going to be leasing other people to do it, it's a valuable thing to have. However, you got to worry about patents. In many cases, a patent is not much more valuable than the amount of resources you're willing to put into it to defend it. If somebody violates your patent and starts building something that is an infringement on your patent and he's taking money away from you, you've now got to take him to a court of law, and the attorney fees and everything else, if it happens to be a big corporation that's doing it or a foreign country, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. So the patent is not the be-all, end-all. It's a good thing to have, but you got to know some of its limitations. Maybe I'm a little bit negative on that. Maybe you've got a slightly different slant. You're the first guy who mentioned the word patent on this one, Mike. I'm going to pass it back to you. It is my opinion you have to be willing to put forth the dollar's worth of resources to defend the patent if you think you're going to run into an infringement problem. That's my quick guess on it. WY2U, you worked on a few patents. K2LAW, over to you, Mike.
Yeah, you're quite right there, Dick. And really, if this gentleman is just building an antenna for himself and maybe something that he wants to share as a freebie with the ham community, it probably isn't even worth it to think about it. If you're working for a bigger company and if you have the resources to have them financially foot the bill, by all means, go for it. It's good for you, and it's good for the company prestige also. And I guess what I'm saying is, unless this fella is perhaps has an inkling to maybe not only patent this antenna, but sell the designs off to someone who's going to build this thing as a manufacturable product, it probably is not worth it, except for maybe bragging rights, and that's about it. Many thousands of dollars and a lot of frustrating hours would have to be put into this, and you really wonder whether or not, unless you're going to get some kind of financial gain out of the thing, whether or not it's worth it at all. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's good to know, Mike. Sounds like you've been there with reference to a lot of patent searches and patent defenses, and so have I. A rough rule of thumb is that I don't think more than about 5% of the patents that have ever been issued ever earned a nickel. And maybe it's a lower number than that. It's nice to have a patent, but just the fact that you got one doesn't mean you're going to get rich quick. 95% of those patents have never earned a dollar, is my belief. Okay, for the next one, John, KC2WGB, that was a goodie. KC2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Dick, I absolutely agree with both you and Mike. If the yield is going to be tremendous, then you buy yourself a shark for an attorney, and he takes a contingency. So, it can work, but there's got to be has two, what I would call whips. They're made out of fiberglass, like a fishing rod. They're approximately 48 inches to 50 inches from what I can tell in the diagram. And they have wire wrapped around them, sort of like the old Shakespeare's. So you have a fiberglass rod about 48 inches, and say, I imagine he's using like maybe 16 gauge wire, has that wrapped around it. Looks like maybe a couple hundred turns, maybe 200 turns. And he has two of these. Now, at the bottom, that's where the coax is going to connect to both of them, common input. The top of them, he has them shorted together. And on one, he has a wire that's connected to the bottom of the antenna with a clip that slides up and down, sort of like a rheostat, on the second one. Now, this antenna, he says, is working. Another one wants to know, what type of antenna would that be? And he said he's getting pretty good results with it. And he's wondering what the direction is, because he noticed the propagation seems to change as he rotates the pair. Strange construction, but he has something here working.
Okay, 48 inches, around 4 feet length. If I understand correctly, these two fiberglass rods both have lots of turns of something like 16 gauge wire. The two of them are connected together at the bottom where they go to the center conductor of the coax feed line, transmission line. The top is also connected together. There's a clip that going down the side that does shorting of some of those turns. So we're changing the amount of distributed inductance along the antenna by way of that clip that does the shorting. I haven't yet heard a description of any ground plane. Where is the shield of the transmission line going? That's not yet clear, John. I may have missed it. And let's have that first. So is the shield of the transmission line connected to something? Maybe it connects to one antenna and the center conductor connects to the other. KC2WGB, K2RIW.